Hi, welcome to Culturally Determined on Blogging Heads TV. My name is Ari Cohen Wade, and I'm your host. And my guest today is Milton Lawson. Milton, could you introduce yourself?
Hi there, I'm Milton Lawson. I'm a new comic writer, and I'm reporting to you live from San Diego Comic-Con.
Great. Well, thanks for coming on, and thanks for being a kind of roving reporter. And we should say full disclosure, you in a previous lifetime were a Blogging Heads employee.
Yes, I was. I was Blogging Heads, jack of all trades. I was an editor. I edited the 5th anniversary video, and did all sorts of things.
But you moved on to greener pastures, and that's what we're talking about today. So you're at San Diego Comic-Con. So
Yes.
for people who may have heard of it, or maybe they never have never even heard of it, what is San Diego Comic-Con, and why does it matter?
I would say that San Diego Comic-Con is the craziest and oldest pop culture gathering. It started in 1970 when a handful of comic and sci-fi fans got together, and among the people that were first on board was legendary Marvel comic artist Jack Kirby. And ever since then, annually, the convention has grown to its gargantuan proportions that it is now. It now hosts over 130,000 attendees during a 4-day convention that starts on Thursday and ends on Sunday. I would say it matters because the sort of just congregation of all the nerd tribes. You've got Hollywood here, you've got publishers here, you've got enthusiasts with all from all sorts of subcultures, ranging from video games, anime. Like one of my best friends is here. He's an original art collector. So if you're into pop culture with a nerd twist to it, your tribe is here and represented, and there's always something fun and interesting to do.
Right, so I think it's kind of interesting that it's even still called Comic-Con, because it seems like it's the place where the Hollywood studios kind of drum up interest and show clips and stuff from their big tentpole, CGI extravaganza movies. And yeah, the problem, I mean, you can tell me, but what percentage of the con is actually devoted to comic books at this point?
It's funny that you should ask me that question because I was curious about the same thing. And thankfully, someone who is a blogger associated exclusively, there, of all the subcultures, there's even a subculture about the con itself. And Leonard Sultana, who runs a podcast called A Cup of Englishmen with a in San Diego, Cup of Tea with an Englishman in San Diego. He crunched the numbers and actually found that this year's programming is about 67% comics related. So even though a lot of the energy and a lot of the buzz and a lot of the enthusiasm comes from the Hollywood presence, for example, this morning the big attraction was a Doctor Who panel, and it was held in an auditorium that seats 6,500 people. The line to get into that panel started, I think, almost 24 hours before the event itself. The line can sometimes stretch a mile and a half, and that is where a lot of the rabid enthusiasm is. But comics is still very well represented. That's why I'm here. It's still the best convention to go to find out and connect with comic creators, comic publishers, editors, and so forth.
Okay, that's interesting. I guess maybe that's the popular perception is not capturing what's really happening. But was in that calculation of you said two-thirds is comic related?
I would say two-thirds of the official programming, in terms of like the panels and just at, actual events on the schedule. Now, as
Right.
far as
But
square
does that
foot,
include like, the next Superman versus Batman movie? Is that part of comics, or is that part of
No,
movies?
that would be counted as part of Hollywood, and
Okay.
most of the big Hollywood productions are limited, are mainly exclusively shown in two big ballrooms they have. There's this one that's legendarily called Hall H, another one that's called Ballroom 20. That they both host thousands of fans at a time. Science fiction shows like Doctor Who, Supernatural, Game of Thrones, Walking Dead. They have huge presence, and they're the hardest things to get into. So that 67% number is maybe perhaps misleading in the sense that if you walk around the con, you'll see a lot of people wearing stuff from TV shows. You'll see a lot of people in costume from various movies, but there's still a strong comics presence.
Right. Okay, so why are you at San Diego Comic-Con in particular?
That's a good question. I ask myself that a little bit every time because it is very it is very taxing logistically. I'm coming here. This is my fifth time here. I'm partially here as a fan because I just am a big fan of a lot of these properties in movies, television, and comics. But I'm also starting out as a comic creator, and this is the highest concentration of comic book talent in the calendar year. So I'm here as a fan to see things, but I'm also here to meet people and network and try to learn more about the craft. There's a wide variety of programs specifically devoted to learning more about your craft. There's also a wide variety of programming called the Comics Arts Conference, which is exclusively devoted to academic studies around comics. And there are some really fascinating programming there. For example, one year I went, and they're coming back with more studies this year. But there's a academic who goes by the Visual Language Lab. I can't remember the guy's name, but he's using modern sort of neuroscience and cognitive analysis to kind of break down the science of how people interpret comics. And they actually show subjects, the simplest form of comics that you can imagine, which is a series of panels from something like Peanuts. And they will do things like they will alter the sequence of the pictures, they'll rearrange things, and they will time the reaction to see, okay, when does a joke land? When does the comprehension happen? When is someone not understanding it because we've rearranged it? So this is kind of a new field in comics, but it's pretty fascinating to get to see that stuff. But I'm also here just to see panels like the one I just saw earlier today with artist David Aja, who just finished an acclaimed run on a Marvel comic series called Hawkeye, which is kind of based on the sort of least powerful, least impressive member of the Avengers. Jeremy Renner plays him in the movies. And they did a series of comics on him where it's kind of like an independent 70s movie, just real low-key. And they used a lot of really innovative storytelling techniques. And so I got to see him talk about his process from thumbnailing to finished product.
Oh, cool. You know, that's actually one of the fewer than five, you know, recent comics that I've read in the past decade or so. I heard something. It was the one where it's told from the dog's perspective.
Yes, yes.
So I did get that one and read it. I thought it was really interesting. So this guy, you know, it's a superhero comic, but this is kind of from the story is told through kind of the first-person, first-animal narration of the dog. And you see, you know, the dog smells stuff and sees little icons of what the smell is. It was really kind of cool and interesting. So Comic-Con is kind of a combination of a fan convention, a industry, like, trade convention, like you would have in any other industry. But then it also has this crazy, like, Hollywood celebrity thing that's glommed onto it in the past.
Yes.
Past couple of years.
Absolutely. And there are a lot of people that camp out just because they want to get really close to the stars of their favorite TV shows. And hang on, my screensaver just went crazy. Back when I worked at Blogging Heads, I always laughed when that happened. And speaking of which, you can run into celebrities here quite frequently, just by happenstance. And literally on my way here to record this video, I had to traipse the entire length of the convention center. It's a pretty big place and it's very crowded. And I ran my way to get here and I turned the corner into this lobby of a hotel adjacent, and I run right into Hollywood actress Heather Graham. So after all of that exercise and seeing Heather Graham, I probably need medical attention.
Do the studios, do they only bring kind of the sci-fi comic book CGI extravaganza movies there at this point, or are they also bringing kind of general interest movies?
They mostly focus on sci-fi types of properties, but every year there's a handful of properties that they bring that are more, you know, traditional three network, procedural type shows, and that there may be a connection to the past work, like the star of the network show might have previously been in a sci-fi show. So there's always a tangential connection, but it still focuses mainly on genre content.
Cool. So why don't we talk about more about why you're there in particular and your path breaking into comics. So why did you decide, after doing jobs such as working at Blogging Heads, why did you decide you wanted to try to make it in comics, and how has that process been going so far, and what do you hope to accomplish at Comic-Con?
Well, the quick version of the narrative is I've always tried to be working towards a writing / creative career, and I did do a tiny bit of writing at Blogging Heads. I did the titles for the UN Plaza series for a number of years, and that was a lot of fun. That was a lot of famine and war and really uplifting topics. But I worked on some screenplays, and I tried to put together a web series, and I was always the kind of focal point in those projects, and it took me a number of failed attempts to realize I just am not good at handling like a large crew of people, a number of actors asking you very good questions simultaneously while you're also trying to figure out the camera angle and in the back of your mind rewrite the script based on the performance you've just seen. And my mind just doesn't act that quickly, so I'm not very good in that context. And I was always frustrated because I didn't really see myself as writing a lot of prose work, because I still tend to think very visually, and comics seemed like the perfect pathway for me, because you've got the visual angle, but you also have the simplicity of dealing with one, two, or three other collaborators when you're dealing with project. Mm-hmm. And the pathway I have taken, at first I just tried to start writing some comic scripts. I read a few comic scripts, and I tried to write them on my own, and they were beyond, they were just terrible. They were beyond incompetent. I'll make a comparison that comes up frequently. There are a lot of people who have some power and juice in Hollywood who try to get projects sort of backdoored through comics, and they'll take a property that they intend to be a screenplay and try to adapt it into a comic, and it never works. And the reason it never works is just because there's an art and science to what you can put on a page, how many pages can dictate a given sequence. And I had to learn those lessons bit by bit by bit, and I was completely lost at first. So I found this fantastic resource online. There is a school for comics creators in all sorts of disciplines, whether they want to learn how to write, learn how to do coloring, learn how to do illustration. And the school is called Comics Experience. And they have courses happening all the time. And they also have an ongoing workshop. And in the workshop, artists and writers constantly put their work up, post it in a protected forum, and subject it to critiques. And there are peer-level critiques that allow you to see, okay, here are some other people around my same level. This is what they think about what I'm doing. This is what's working. This is what's failing. And they also have hosts who come in from the industry. The school is run by a former editor at Marvel. His name is Andy Schmidt. And if you liked the movie Guardians of the Galaxy, it's partly due to the comics he helped edit. And he has created this fantastic environment for people who want to learn. And professionals come in, critique the arts, critique the scripts. And just through iteration, they give you like monthly homework assignments to, you know, write a story or draw a picture based on a certain theme. And through focusing on those really narrow topics, I was able to go from being totally incompetent to being, you know, halfway passable.
Mm-hmm. Cool. So you sent me, and you maybe have at hand, an interesting kind of short story Yes. Well, I mean, what would you call you call it a graphic novel. Is it a graphic short story?
I think it can fall under any category you want to put it on. Call it a comic book, call it a graphic novel, short, call it anything. I may at some point take this particular short and expand it into a full-length graphic novel. So let's just call it the preview of a graphic novel to be asterisk maybe. So what you're referring to is my first comic short. It's titled Winter Sail, and I've got a printed version that you can see here. It's illustrated by a fantastic artist named Dave Chisholm, and it's about an independent music shop in the Midwest struggling with how to work in the retail industry in the modern age.
And we'll link to it because you've also posted it on your website, and I liked it a lot. And maybe if there's some people who are watching or listening to this who've never read a comic before, you know, this one will go down easy. It's maybe 8 or so pages, and I think you'll probably enjoy it. So this could be a little kind of entry into the world of graphic novels for someone who has never perused one before, but is interested in the genre. So how have you found it? You know, how has it been trying to break into this industry?
It's been extremely challenging and rewarding. It's, you know, I had certain goals in mind when I started. I made the decision, all right, I'm going to start doing comics in 2010. And I thought, okay, at the end of 2011, I'll have my first comic finished. And that was radically naive. It took me a couple of years just to learn the form. The biggest challenge after learning the form, which can be understated, is finding collaborators. And there's an interesting pendulum that swings in the comic industry in terms of the power level between the artist and the writer. And there have been certain decades where the artists have been dominant, like the 1990s. In comics in particular, were dominated by artists. The artists were the big names. They are who drove sales. And the pendulum has swung to the other side recently. It's dominated by writers. However, for myself, someone who's at the very bottom, that power differential is kind of inverted because you're not going to have a comic unless you have good art. And you're not going to have good art unless you can find a good artist. And if there's a good artist out there, Marvel Comics or DC or Image Comics is going to snatch them up because there's a lot less supply and a lot more demand. So I've spent countless hours trolling art forums where up and coming artists post their work, and I stalk certain people that have good taste. I have some custom searches, and after going through 3 or 4 projects where I've actually hired artists, I've kind of built a small network of people who I can trust and reach out to and learn about. But it's still an ongoing process, finding collaborators. You know, sometimes it works well. I was beyond lucky in terms of who I found to work with on this short called Winter Sail. Finding folks of that caliber is quite a challenge that I'm consistently trying to do.
Did you ever think about doing the art yourself?
I am woefully inept at anything related to illustration. I'm pretty good at doing silly Photoshops.
Some of our viewers may recall some occasionally the screenshots for a dialogue would be something silly. The one that sticks in my mind was, I guess it was about 7 years ago, when the stock market crashed, and it crashed, I think the Dow went down 777 points. And do you remember this one? And Bob, with Dan Dresner, and you photoshopped us that they looked like they were from the movie The Seventh Seal. You always had that ability. I mean, have you thought? Did you think about doing something along those lines with like a photo illustration or photo manipulation?
Somewhat. I have an idea that would allow me to maybe work with a system of rapidly developed short recurring character type things, but that's still highly in the tentative stages. But I'm mainly focused on writing and finding good artists, and at the moment I'm in a good place because I'm focused on one project in particular, and I'm not at liberty to disclose when it may be released, but it has found a publisher, and it's in the science fiction genre, which is kind of more my first gear. My second gear is doing independent stories like Winter Sail, but most of the things I work on are science fiction, and I'm working with an artist to deliver that, and hopefully after that particular project concludes, I'll be able to reach out and find even more art friends to have my next project.
Mm-hmm. Do you see a difference between writing in a realistic style, which is what Winter Sail is, and writing in kind of the more traditional comic book, you know, sci-fi, supernatural occurrences style?
Yes, very much so. One of the things that I've learned in the workshop is just how radically different certain genres can be. One of the homework assignments they gave us was a superhero comic. And I would love to one day write a superhero comic for one of the mainstream publishers. It's not my primary focus. I would rather work on original pieces, but I would definitely like to work on licensed property at some point. And I learned through just a very simple exercise in which they had us combine a character that's a known character and put it in a completely unfamiliar environment. And the first story I wrote in the superhero genre was insanely difficult, probably the second most difficult thing I've ever had to write in the workshop. But I was relieved at the end because it was appreciated. One of the professionals in the forum gave me some kudos on it. And he said, he kind of jokingly said, yeah, this stuff's a lot harder than it looks, isn't it? And I absolutely agreed. It was absolutely taxing because it's such a well-known genre. All of the tropes have been exploited infinitely. And to find a new take on that format is quite a challenge.
Mm-hmm. Okay, why don't we talk a little bit about... Well, I'll let you decide. Do you want to talk about more about the con itself, or do you want to talk about your blog post about revolutions in comics?
I guess we could go with the blog post. The con has really only just started, so I have very few anecdotes that I can convey other than I started out seeing the panel celebrating the 75th anniversary of the Superman radio drama. And this is a very interesting piece of American pop culture history because a lot of what we consider fundamental core elements of the Superman character actually originated not in the comics, but on the radio program.
Huh. That's where It's a Bird, It's a Plane. Isn't that where that originally came from?
Yeah. That's where It's a Bird, It's a Plane comes from, and that's where Kryptonite came from, and the history of it is somewhat in dispute, but the convenient version of the story is they needed something to let the Superman voice actor have a two-week vacation but keep the program running, so they invented Kryptonite to sort of put him in a situation where he's depowered and unable to help the day for a couple of weeks.
Oh, wow, that's amazing.
And now
Kryptonite is like something that everyone, whether you know anything about Superman or not, you know about. Just it's become like a, you know, a metaphor for, you know, the thing that can take all your power away, and everyone knows Kryptonite. Interesting. Okay, so why don't we talk a little bit about your blog post, which we'll link to. So you see a lot of change in the comics industry over the past half decade. You identified four different areas. Well, why don't we start talking about... Let's go with the ownership one. So...
Sure.
So traditionally, you know, the majority of comics that people read were put out by two big companies, DC and Marvel. And then there started to be some independent ones in the 90s. A big one was called Image. But there always were kind of small press people basically, you know, spending their own money and putting it out there. And then the ability for creators to own their own properties and has really changed. Where before, all the classic characters from DC and Marvel that we know and love, like Superman and Spider-Man and Batman, these were all done under contract, and often the creators, you know, were paid very poorly for them, and in some cases they have been compensated in recent years, or their estates have been compensated because they're no longer alive, like Jack Kirby. So why don't you talk a little bit about how ownership has changed in comics?
Yes. In general, I found I happen to, you know, make this commitment to work in comics at a really pivotal time in the history, because if you look back over the past 5 years and compare a number of aspects of the industry to where it was 5 years ago, there have been very significant changes. And ownership, the change there really started in 2008. Robert Kirkman, the writer who's famously known for the comic The Walking Dead and the television show adaptation, he posted a manifesto video on the web, basically a call to arms, trying to convince sort of the middle layer of talent in the big two publishing companies to address their frustrations with their creative limitations, to address their frustrations with their financial compensation by making the switch to going full-time to creating original properties. And at first, this pledge was kind of seen as a little bit self-serving. In addition to being one of the leading creators for Image Comics, Kirkman is also one of the executives. And they said, okay, yeah, it's convenient for you to say this to try to poach our talent. But in actuality, what has occurred over the past 5 years, in 2009, there was a book published named Chew, which I've got a copy of here, which has a really bizarre premise, but it's a hilarious book about an investigator who solves crimes by consuming organic material. And it takes place in a post-apocalyptic food apocalypse where the avian flu has created a situation where chicken has been outlawed, and the FDA is the primary governmental organization. Mm-hmm. And this crazy book that's just brimming with imagination in all corners just set the sales chart on fire. It was reprinted multiple times, and other comics creators took a look at that and said, hey, these guys are doing what they want to do on their terms, and they're not selling as many books as, say, like the, you know, 15th most popular Marvel or DC title, but there is no corporate overhead that they're dealing with. So they're actually making more money personally, or the same money, and they own their books. And as the books go into reprints and into collections, and as the books get adapted into animated pictures or movies or television series, all of those rewards come directly to them. So after Chew, there was a book called Saga, which was just a gangbuster success. And once that book hit the market, it was a deluge. And a lot of the big names for Marvel and DC started saying, hey, I went in on this. And there are a dozen just really high-profile, talented creators who are publishing their own thing. They're either doing it through independent publishers like Image or Dark Horse, or in some cases they're just doing it directly online.
And didn't Marvel have a creator-owned imprint?
Yes.
At some point?
Yes, and I believe it is still going, but I have inferred that the arrangements are maybe not to the best benefit, and I may be completely wrong on this. This is just based on inference, but a number of books that used to be on their imprint have transitioned over to other publishers. Mm-hmm. So I think it mainly caters to a handful of very specific Marvel creators, but most of the energy behind that line, I think, is kind of just narrowly focused.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think this is interesting because, you know, in most media industries, there's been consolidation, not splintering. Well, maybe I'm overstating things, but you can think, like, you know, in book publishing, you know, like, there was this huge consolidation and all the imprints were bought up until it became Random House merged with Penguin, the two biggest merged together. And, you know, this idea that there would be a revolt against the giant powers that be seems a little counterintuitive. Although maybe with the internet, you know, you see this kind of splintering happening in other places, because, you know, it's not like the New York Times absorbs other local newspapers. Maybe just the local newspaper goes out of business, and then someone will, like, start a local blog or something that kind of, like, serves some mm-hmm. of the purpose of that local newspaper that went out of business.
One factor could just simply be that the economics here are different enough. The comic market is specifically the monthly comic book series. It's a very narrow niche. They're, you know, very success. You can consider some books very successful that only sell 12,000 copies.
Mm-hmm.
The biggest, like in the 90s, the biggest Marvel comics would sell a million copies. Nowadays, the top ones, the top three or four, break out and do huge numbers for sort of quirky reasons every time. But in general, a big hit would be a little over 100,000 copies. So, and it's only a $3 or $4 book. So,
right.
There's not as much, you know, at stake here. So.
Right. So, I mean, why don't we transfer to another area you wrote about? And I think the contrast is interesting. So, a really successful, like, the most successful comic every month is maybe selling 100,000 copies. But then Hollywood has kind of been taken over by comic books. And,
yeah.
And if a movie only sells 100,000 tickets, it's a flop.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Avengers movies sell like $1 billion worth of tickets. So how do you think these, you know, how do you put these facts together? Do you think the fact that comic movies are dominating the box office is good for comics themselves or bad for comics themselves?
I think that it's a complicated answer. There are certain elements of comic book fandom that would argue that they're bad for comics, specifically the poor adherence of the X-Men franchise. They are a much set-upon group. They have my sympathy somewhat, due simply to the fact that Marvel does not own the movie licenses for the X-Men characters. In the comic universe, they have been relegated to a sort of inferior status. And there's an entire community.
In the 90s, the X-Men were the most popular superhero team.
Yeah,
And that was really the first big Marvel movie was X-Men, which I think came out in 99 or 2000. But yeah, I think it's like 20th Century Fox or something owns the rights instead of Marvel. So that means that Marvel has been paying less attention to X-Men within the comics universe?
Yes. They still are a big property within the universe, and they do sell a lot, and they do put a lot of their best talent on the book. So it's the narrative of it being diminished is somewhat hyped by that group, but there is some truth in what they say as well, because whenever there is a big push, about once a year or twice a year, Marvel will have an event that brings together their entire cast of characters spanning their entire universe. And previously, the X-Men would usually be front and center in that. And the most recent ones, they've been kind of supporting characters. But there's another side to this too, though. For fans of really good creators and the career freedom that it gives people, sort of in line with the ownership revolution. Look at a creator like Jeff Lemire. He's a comic artist who's done, he writes and draws. He has done independent work to much acclaim, very low-key stuff. My favorite book of his is a book called Essex County, And it's a book about youth growing up sort of in a northern Canadian small town, about kids playing hockey. And it sort of has a sensibility not unlike a Terrence Malick film. And this is just a beautiful thing. And it's very peculiar. And for people who like that sort of thing, it's available. But now, given the success in television and Hollywood, he has developed his own project called Descender, which is a futuristic story about a sort of android boy robot who may or may not be the cause of much chaos throughout the galaxy. And sort of a Steven Spielbergian sweet story about a robot from his point of view. And he has the freedom.
This is going to be a movie?
This is going to be a television series. Signed a development deal, I think, several months ago. And the ability to have those types of development deals, he has won a couple of the best-known creators in independent comics and mainstream comics is Matt Diffraction and Kelly Sue DeConnick. And they have partnered into their own studio and or their own label. I'm not sure it would be called a studio. And they have multiple television and film adaptations being worked on. And this frees them up because these people used to work exclusively on B-level and C-level Marvel characters. And in the case of Matt Fraction, he's a guy that's so talented, he can take a C-level character like Hawkeye and turn it into something brilliant. But a lot of these C-level superhero comics, they miss the mark. And they're a bit frustrating creatively because you've got to have one out every month. And this particular character might have a certain backstory that you've got to work in. You've got an event that might be happening elsewhere in the Marvel comic book universe or DC comic book universe. And so it's a very stifling sort of part of the market, and this new ownership revolution allows people to make the choice, hey, I don't necessarily have to do that one, I'll do my own thing.
Right. Now, maybe here's a question that maybe you could decline to answer if you don't want to. I mean, would you want to write for a big superhero comic at DC or Marvel? Is that kind of like seen as, you know, the big league still, of like that's, you're making it if you're writing Spider-Man? Is that a goal of yours or not?
It is a sort of midpoint goal of mine, and I would consider it like a tree branch in a scenario of if that opportunity were able to happen for me, I would relish it and do everything I could to make it the best I could. However, you know, a lot of comic book career trajectories right now are, You get some sort of following based off of independent work, then you graduate, so forth, to doing a sort of C-level, D-level character for someone like Marvel or DC. And then once your name might get recognized, you can go back to doing independent work and either do that simultaneously with creator-owned work or focus exclusively on Marvel. There are a number of characters from the Marvel and DC canon that I would love to get my hands on, but of course I would tend to be the kind of guy who would do really crazy and outlandish things with them, so they might not get approved. So I would like that opportunity.
Okay, well, I hope you will get it someday. Do you want to talk about diversity or digital, or should we move on to something else?
I think we could do a quick little bit on both of them. I'll try to narrow it down. The diversity thing is quite simply, it's mostly focused on the content, but it's also true behind the scenes. As short as 2011, there were a lot of signs that there were demographic problems with the comic book readership. There was a famous market research study handled by Nielsen at the behest of DC Comics to study what was the readership, because there hasn't been a lot of analysis of who buys comics. And what they found was that it was 93% male, And there was only about 6% of people who were new readers. And that seemed to be a death spiral. And that seemed to be quite a cause for concern. And then you combine the readership problem with the fact that that particular audience was sometimes pandered to with really cheesy and salacious pictorial content and made some of their female characters look really outrageously objectified. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of pushback, and they were losing a lot of potential female fans because of this. And there were some really prominent examples, and there were some sort of internet campaigns behind protesting given pieces of art. And through my perception, over the past 5 years, the editorial teams have heard these complaints and responded. They have redesigned a number of their feminine superheroes into more realistic and interesting costumes that still look cool, still look like superheroes, but they're not objectifying. Uh-huh. And once they made the first few steps with that type of aesthetic, the sales just went off the charts, and the creators who promoted those kind of books were celebrated by a new range of fans. And beyond gender diversity, there were a number of steps towards increasing the racial diversity of characters. The most prominent example, Marvel previously had a separate line of books called the Ultimate Universe of books, which began as a sort of experimental wing of the Marvel brand, and they took their iconic characters and did different things with them. And so one of the things they did was they killed off that version of Spider-Man. They killed off Peter Parker and replaced him with a half African-American, half Hispanic hero named Miles Morales. And Miles Morales donned a new Spider-Man costume. It was a brilliantly designed costume by Sarah Pacelli, and the writer on the project is one of Marvel's most accomplished writers, Brian Michael Bendis. And and the book was a phenomenal success, and the design of the costume and the multiracial aspect of the character resonated with fans. You go to conventions and you'll see people dressing as the character. And by my mind, he's the most successful new character that Marvel has created in decades. So there's been a number...
Before I stopped reading comics, Ultimate Spider-Man was really one of the last ones I was still reading. I really like Bendis a lot, but I stopped before that happened, so maybe I should try picking up some of the trade paperbacks and see this transition.
Yeah, very entertaining stuff. And in the mainstream Marvel universe, there is a teenage character named Ms. Marvel, who is a Muslim teenage girl, and it's one of the best written comics, not just in superhero comics, but in comics general. And her book has been a huge success. A lot of people dress up as her at conventions, and that character has been sort of promoted. Marvel is relaunching their entire line in a few months, and she is promoted from just being a single character to joining one of the Avengers teams. Uh-huh. And the mantle of Captain America has been passed to the character of Sam Wilson, the African-American character formerly known as the Falcon, who you may have seen in the Captain America Winter Soldier movie. So all of these steps have created a more diverse set of characters on the pages, and behind the pages there are more female creators. One of the most powerful creators in the industry right now is Kelly Sue DeConnick. She has written Captain Marvel. She's written Avengers Assemble and a number of very high-profile books for Marvel. And there's still an enormous amount of room to grow in the industry. But compared to where it was 5 years ago, I think it's made enormous strides.
Mm-hmm. Okay, why don't we touch briefly on digital? So, I mean, comic books, their books, they're pieces of paper stapled together. It seems very old-fashioned. The printed media industry in whatever form it is, newspapers, magazines, books, has been, are pretty much all struggling with the digital transition. So how has the comics industry done with the digital transition?
Well, the digital transition started out with a lot of fans sort of like banging on the table, where's my digital, where's my digital? Because for ever since Napster, the expectation of digital content has been set for people. And when the iTunes store was so successful in transforming the music industry, a lot of observers, like between 2008 and 2010, were looking at the comic industry and wondering why they were taking so long to sell their books digitally. And there was a lot of hesitation in selling digitally because, the like I've said previously, the economics are just very narrow, the profit margin is very thin, and the relationship between the comic book publishers and the main distributor and the retail channels that sell the books is very precarious. And there was a lot of pressure from retailers who were worried that once you sell the books digitally, there will be no incentive to come into the store. Because there are a lot of comics fans who, they call them Wednesday warriors, who hit the shop Wednesday morning when the new books come out and can take to the internet and start arguing the latest events that occurred in the books. Mm-hmm. And of course with social media, that happens even sooner. And so the retailers were worried, like, hey, you know, you're going to start selling these things at midnight. By the time my store opens at 10 a.m., the fact that Wolverine was killed, spoiler, is already, you know, old news. So there was
It just seems so antiquated, even though this is, you know, in a world where you can get something from Amazon delivered to your house within 48 hours and everyone has a smartphone. The idea that you would like drive to a store to buy these pieces of paper, you know, on a specific day, even though that's what people were doing 5-10 years ago, it does seem very antiquated at this point.
Absolutely, absolutely. But then they put their toe in the water and they found that the numbers were great. They increased exponentially the first few years, and much to the delight of everyone in the industry, creators, publishers, retailers, retail sales actually grew. And I think there are a lot of reasons for that. Like, just anecdotally myself, I would get frustrated when there would be a snafu in the publication process, and let's say you're following Hawkeye, and for whatever reason, number 11 got delayed a month, and you didn't go to the store that month, and it was sold out by the time you got there. By the time number 12 came out, if they didn't have a back issue available, you know, comic nerds are notoriously completists, and I'm definitely one of them. I want to know what happened to number 11. Right. So digital would supplement the retail experience because, hey, if you've got a gap, go buy it digitally.
Mm-hmm. How are people viewing digital comics? Is it kind of like they're using a tablet to kind of read it and flip the pages that way, or are they looking at it on a regular computer screen, or is there some other... There's no equivalent of the Kindle, I assume, for comics.
No, but I believe that there are some Kindle-friendly comics already made, but the answer to how it's being consumed is sort of all over the place. The primary method is through the iPad, but even or other tablet devices. But even within that space, you've got two radically different experiences that occur because a number of books are processed in a way to where you can either choose to read the book at the full page to fill up your tablet screen, or you can have what they call guided view, and it zooms in on a panel-by-panel basis, and you can consume the story that way. And if you look at guided view, that's a little more friendly towards a phone device. Mm-hmm. So there are ways to consume this regardless of device. And in addition to the ways that traditional comics can be consumed, there's the start of a creative revolution in terms of how you present a comic when you have new technological capabilities at your fingertips. Mm-hmm. And there have been attempts in the past to do what they call motion comics. And motion comics were really just bad animation. They're not very entertaining.
The ones that I saw always looked pretty lame to me.
Yeah. They were very creatively stifling, and they didn't the fundamental problem with them is that they just weren't comics. So a lot of creators have been wondering, is there something that can take advantage of digital technology and still call itself comics? And the answer to that, I believe, is being seen first with a series of comics written by Mark Waid, who's famously known for a number of Superman stories. He has been investigating what you can do with transitions and layering, and you can end up having new experiences digitally, but it's still reading a comic.
Mm-hmm. Cool. We're probably nearing the end of our time. Do you want to maybe talk a little bit about, I think I've asked this in other conversations I've had with people about comic books. I mean, what would you recommend that's out now for someone who has never read a comic before or knows very little about comics? What comic would you put in their hands and say, read this and you will get it and you will fall in love with comic books?
Well, the first one I would recommend is the book that we referenced earlier, this book called Chew. It's a comedy. It's bizarre. It has a sense of humor. It is packed with Easter eggs in the background, illustrated by the artist, inside jokes, it's got a little bit of a kind of almost superhero-y type of vibe, in the sense that the detective in the case has a form of superpowers, but you find that sort of thing on network television as well. So you've got the grounded nature of like a procedural investigation. There are various food-related crimes and food-related powers, and like, for example, one of the characters is called a Sabo Scrivener, and what a Sabo Scrivener is able to do is anything that person writes, anyone who reads it has the experience of experiencing what it's like to eat the food that was described. So there's another character who cannot eat food without having horrific experiences. So they're quite a match made in heaven. Another comic I would recommend, which would be a segue for film fans, if you liked the movie Fight Club, the author of the original book that the movie was based on is writing a graphic novel sequel appropriately titled Fight Club 2. And in Fight Club 2, we get to see what is happening to the character that used to be played by Edward Norton, and see what 10 years of age and domestication does to him and his alter ego, Tyler Durden.
Interesting.
Another comic I would recommend, which I would describe as a sort of crime movie meshed up with the television drama Friday Night Lights, and it's called Southern Bastards. It's about a crime boss in a small Alabama town who happens to also be the head football coach. And I'm showing some pictures here of what the art style is like. So if you're a fan of Friday Night Lights or the original deep-fried exploitation Southern Walking Tall genre, you can be entertained by that. I think fans of Blogging Heads, the thing I would most recommend to them is a graphic novel series called March, which is a series of biographical comics co-written by Congressman John Lewis, in which he chronicles his history with the civil rights movement from its inception to the lunch counter protests, to the freedom rides, to the March on Washington. And the congressman is actually here at Comic-Con, and I hope to be attending the panel that he will be at later this week.
Oh, wow, that's awesome.
It's a fantastic series. It immerses you in the details of the civil rights movement, the quiet moments, the behind the scene moments from John Lewis's point of view. Mm-hmm. And it's rendered by a just extraordinarily gifted artist who has an iconic and cartoony style. So it's got a bit of a timeless quality to it. And if it's not already a textbook in high schools and middle schools, I think it will be in the future when the series is concluded. I think the final book in the series is going to be released next year.
Mm-hmm. Cool. When you had a recommendation for Blogging His Viewers, that reminded me that I have a possible recommendation for Blogging His Viewers, which is something I read a couple years ago, Ex Machina or Ex Machina. Have you read that one?
I've read most of it, not all of it, but yeah, that is a fantastically interesting story.
Right, so just basically the plot of that one is, you know, it takes place in the real world, and then there's one person who has superpowers, and on September 11th, he stops the second plane from crashing into the second tower. And because of this great feat, he's elected mayor of New York. And so he has these powers, and it deals with, like, local politics and, you know, what mm-hmm. would happen if someone actually did have powers in, you know, in the real world, but there's only one of them. It's a really interesting concept and well executed.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Okay, we're probably about at the end of our time. Is there anything else you want to say before we go?
Just hello to Blogging Heads Nation, and apologies to Dan Dresner for all the times I defaced him in Photoshop, but it was with a good heart.
Well, I'm glad we're able to get you in front of the camera after many years when you were toiling anonymously behind the camera. And yeah, we should add the famous fifth anniversary, We Didn't Start the Fire. You were integral in putting that together. Thank you, Milton, for coming on. And thank you to all of our viewers and listeners. And we'll see you again next time.
Thanks for having me.